Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland. I am one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is a panel of lawyers, and San Diego is very well represented for our discussion of She-Hulk Episode 6, Just Jen. How is everyone doing this evening? Starting with Kathy, because you're the first in the Zoom screen.
I am well, thank you.
Good. Jordan?
Doing pretty well, thanks.
Excellent. Io?
All good here in Texas.
Outstanding. And Daphne?
Wonderful, here in San Diego.
Excellent. All right, well, let's get into the multiverse of legal issues in this episode that focus on divorce and settlement and what it means to die. And then what happens when you go to a wedding and you start a fight? So first things first, the legal side of this focuses on an individual named Mr. Immortal, who when he dies, he suddenly gets better. So he's apparently married lots of individuals, which means, is he a bigamist or, as Kathy put it, a serial monogamist? A lot to talk about there. So first things first, let's talk about what is bigamy. And Daphne, can you help us understand what bigamy is? So, we're working on getting off mute, but that's okay. So pivoting to the outline, bigamy is the act of marrying one person while still married to another. That's from the Westlaw Black's Law Ninth Dictionary app. The law only allows you to marry one person at a time. And it's a no-no to have more than one spouse. Now, California Family Code Section 2201 gets into the issues of what happens when you have somebody marrying multiple times. A subsequent marriage contracted by one person during the life of a former husband or wife of the person with a person other than the former husband or wife is illegal and void from the beginning unless the former marriage has been dissolved or annulled before the date of the subsequent marriage, or two, the former husband or wife is absent and not known to the person to be living for the period of five successive late years immediately preceding the subsequent marriage, or it is generally reputed or believed by the person to be dead at the time of the subsequent marriage was contracted. So death ends marriages. And that's how you can get out of one. There are less extreme measures, such as divorce, and all the permutations of that in our rich body of case law in a country where 50% of marriages end in divorce. So, and if you're a lawyer, that might actually be a little higher. So there's that fun fact as well. So how do we define this guy? Who wants to take the first stab at Mr. Immortal, who can die and then just keeps getting married?
I'll chat. I think he's a bigamist, right? I think that he's conveniently allowing, you know, he's sort of no different. And you guys know, I think at this point, I like to make analogies, but I think he's no different than someone who fakes their own death and runs away to leave their partner and moves to, you know, New Mexico and takes on a new life. Like, you are still married because you sort of only get one lifetime, right? Like, the number of interruptions you get in it and your ability to return from the dead, especially because he does it so quickly. I think that's the part to me, right? Like, it's not like he's like dead and buried and there's a death certificate and all of these things. And then, you know, 72 hours later, his, you know, ringing a bell and getting out of his, you know, where he's buried or whatever. So I think that, yeah, our guy is, I mean, just, he is a person who marries more than one person while technically legally married to another, even though, of course, his, you know, partner at the time of his multiple deaths all following that death. He also sort of puts them at risk for being, you know, guilty of bigamy, because, you know, once one believes that their partner is dead and they mourn and move on and find someone, and, you know, if they choose to get married to that new person, they're technically bigamous because their initial husband, Mr. Immortal, is not actually dead. And, you know, I was just thinking of how his name is so apt. Like if someone said, "Hi, I'm Mr. Immortal," well, I'm gonna assume that you're not dead, whatever I hear. Also, I thought that his name shouldn't actually be Immortal. It should be Mr., you know, come back to life, or like it's like a vampire. Like they don't die, because like if you shoot them, they come back to life. I think that's a little different than true immortality. Or maybe vampires don't. I don't know the whole thing about vampires, but
oh, we have a lot of Halloween material that gets into the vampires and the undead, but that's a different discussion. Stay tuned for Halloween, because we do have Werewolf by Night coming from Disney. So a lot of fun there. Now, just as a history geek moment, does anyone know which U.S. president was a bigamist by accident? No. Andrew Jackson is the answer. So in the election of 1828, when he, 24, when he wins against John Quincy Adams, part of the campaign accused him of being a bigamist because his wife's marriage hadn't been fully annulled at the time that they were married. And she was so distraught because of how bad the campaign was, she died before Inauguration Day. So, yeah, it was a nasty election. But yeah, Andrew Jackson, technically a bigamist, in addition to being illiterate. But anyway, on to the other parts of this. So why have the trademark lawyer handle this settlement case with former spouses, or potentially still existing spouses? So once somebody identified the attorney competency issue with this, who wants to jump into this?
I threw that in there, so I will. Okay. I think this is a cautionary tale of, you know, don't hire a trademark lawyer to do your divorce. Don't hire the criminal defense lawyer to talk about trademarks. Lawyers, we pass a bar exam and that qualifies us to practice whatever kind of law people will hire us for, technically, but it is a bad idea to hire someone who is not specialized in the field you're looking for. And I think this particular instance shows why, because you end up with, and I will get to this in a minute, but you end up with Nikki, the paralegal, doing most of the negotiating, and she ends up negotiating against the guy who's paying them, against Mr. Immortal. And so, you know, be careful who you hire.
Yeah, it is weird, because it's the paralegal crossing into the practice of law at that point. So two issues there. One, is Book competent to be doing this? So is this actually a good idea? And two, does Nikki cross into from being paralegal to negotiating a settlement? Does that turn into the unauthorized practice of law? Who would like to jump in on that?
Well, I'll just to defend Ms. Book for a minute. She is competent to do it, clearly, but it's not a good idea to have her doing it if that's not her practice area. I mean, laws are specialized enough that you want someone who knows the ins and outs of it, and not just the statutory law, but the case law. And, you know, the most recent cases from an appellate court on what, I don't know, bigamy or voidable might mean. But someone who's up on all of that and who can deal with that case in the apparently very, very quick time manner that we've gotten used to in this show, where things go, I'm going to hire a lawyer, and then it's resolved in half an hour. Gotta love sitcoms.
Yeah, that's there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I, as I was going through books from storage this weekend, that included my old community property book. And there's volumes of case law in California on community property, from whether it's the See's Candy case to the Marvin case. So it's a nice, rich, complicated body of law. And I didn't quite understand how procedurally this was happening. If Mr. Immortal was just trying to clear his name of all of the potential ex-spouses that he has floating around, that still raises the issue for prosecution, because you can't go around marrying people if you already are married. So generally speaking, any of those represented parties should be wary that they can't go and turn him in as part of leverage for settlement discussions, because then you're threatening criminal prosecution as part of the consideration for any settlement. And luckily that doesn't come up, but you know, it raises the ugly issue that in divorce cases, both parties should be represented. And it did not look like any of the former spouses or victims had legal counsel with them. So they're negotiating directly with Mr. Immortal's legal department. So it's a very weird situation to be in.
And each of the former wives should have their own counsel, because they each have different interests and different investments that they put into that marriage. So, you know, there was one that said that you know, she raised the son alone and he never gave her a dime. And then there was the guy who paid the $10,000 for the jazz funeral. And then there was the woman who gave up her job for 2 years to help him run a jade shop in Piedmont, which is near where I used to live. So I thought I liked that reference. So they each have their own individual interests. And so for them not to be represented, but they should all, and then them all be in the room with the opposing counsel and the other party was weird. You know, I'm like, what is this setting? Is this just an informal pre-litigation come to Jesus meeting, or is it something else?
Yeah. Is he trying to be preempt any litigation against him and to settle this so he can go forward with his very long life that will end when the universe ends? So it's a really weird legal situation to be in, because this isn't just Highlander with, you know, he's changing his identity every, you know, 50, 60 years and inheriting his own property. So that way it, you know, it doesn't raise red flags that, you know, someone can live forever. This is different because we have all these former spouses, and technically the first one might still be the spouse and the others are all voidable marriage. I mean, like, they're not effective. They were never effective to begin with because he was out married, and the way to get out of a marriage is not jumping out of a window.
Well, he mentioned his first wife had left him all the gold. And so that I was unclear as to how did he get out of that relationship? Did she perish? And he inherited.
It sounds like he's been marrying for a long time, because there was somebody who sounded like from antiquity. And it's like, okay, so if you're inheriting like gold bars from a princess in the 17th century, okay, that's yours. And that marriage ended when the wife died. It gets weird where, what was the last marriage to someone still living? Because that's the marriage that's still valid. Everything else after that's not effective. So that could, again, it's the criminal prosecution. There's all kinds of things that follow.
And depending on the timeline, even the last living spouse might not be a valid marriage if he was married at the time he married that spouse. So it has to be your spouse dies, then you get married. And that's the one that's...
There can be no overlap.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because again, hypotheticals don't happen in real life, because you don't have people living for millennia.
These hypotheticals don't happen in real life, but when I was in private practice, I did represent someone who got married to another person who was already married in a different state. My client found out about it and we ended up having to void their marriage. That was kind of an interesting case. So it does happen from time to time in real life.
Yeah, turns out my great great grandmother had her marriage invalidated because of abandonment. That actually went to the Texas Supreme Court. So, but that's another long, complicated story. But anyway, my family inadvertently made case law.
Cool.
In the 19th century. So long ago. Let's get into the other claims that we get. And Mark raised these that, you know, what's the legal definition of death? Jordan, you found a definition from Oregon. Why don't you share that for everybody?
Sure. So Oregon defines death for inheritance purposes, trusts and estates. Skipping through the beginning bit, death occurs when an individual has sustained irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions, or when there has been an irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem. The determination of death must be made in accordance with acceptable medical standards. So that brings up the other question of, I assume Mr. Immortal has never been officially declared dead by like a medical examiner, which would probably be required under, I assume, under California's trust and estates law. It seems prudent before you inherit stuff.
Yeah, and the challenge that we have with Mr. Immortal is he bounces back quickly from being dead. It's not like he's dead for a day or an hour. He slowly heals and recovers.
Yeah, I don't think it meets the definition of sustained irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions, or the functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, because it is reversible, right? He comes back to life.
Yeah, it's
for him, it's reversible.
Yeah, for anyone else, they would have been, you know, a stain on the sidewalk for jumping out of a window, but he recovers from it almost immediately. So it's, you know, there have been shows like Resurrection from, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, and others where somebody dies, they're dead for a while, and then they come back. This is not one of those situations that he heals. So it's different that death might not be effective as a way to get out of anything.
Now questionably canon Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. when Coulson died and was sent to Tahiti.
Yeah, and with him, and I have a couple good blog posts about that. He was dead and he like didn't get better overnight. So they had to do alien science and using Kree blood to put him back together. And all of that was, one, have an advanced health directive so this sort of thing doesn't happen to you, and make sure it's, you know, Nick Fury isn't the person who has power of attorney over you, because it could get weird fast. That said, he was dead. So that estate should have been gone through probate. Time had passed. There's a death certificate. He's done. This is not that situation. So, which raises the issue, if you can live forever, and not to do a spin on the Queen song, who wants to get into the issue of, are you committing fraud every few decades? Or are you just going to pretend that, yeah, I was born in 1642 and here I am? Like, when you're getting a new driver's license, does it say I was born in 1642? Mm-hmm. Or are you updating it and changing your name every 70 years? And if so, isn't that fraud? Are you like trying to find a social security number from somebody who died and to continue on. It's immortality has some weird spins to it. So either one of our government lawyers want to weigh into this?
Yeah, I'll just dip in here. There are so many elements of fraud. And when you really look at this, if we look at that definition of death and remove that, because what we're working with really doesn't meet that definition, you just kind of have your standard con artist who wants a little bit of escape, decides, all right, I want a do-over. I'm going to leave that life that I just built. I'm going to start over somewhere else. And so I'm removing for the moment that his means of escape was faking his own death each time. Now you just have that regular person who decides to leave, pick up somewhere else. And now he has the added level of criminal charges that can be filed against him for faking his own death. But at each turn, you have a new name with each of these sauces. So yeah, there's so many layers of a lot of forgery in here.
Yeah, this was different before Franklin Delano Roosevelt and in mass communication, somebody just like up and leaving and going to Missouri after living in California and I'm just going to have a little cabin here and be a general contractor and stay off the grid. Not an option in this day and age. So there's a digital footprint and a bureaucracy attached to every living person. So you can't just get around that nowadays. So the amount of work that would have to go into being immortal and will only get more complicated as the sometime in the 23rd century, I'm pretty sure would be more complicated to do than the 21st. So would hate to represent.
Only if you want to stay in America, you know? Oh, you can theoretically, I mean. Kind of wander around the world. That's how I would do it. I would sort of live a very different life in very many different places, like some of the Eternals did. The what's the name now? The youngest one, the one that was like stuck as
I haven't seen the movie, but in the comics, I think it's Sprite.
Yeah. Sprite, yes. And I can't remember their gender from the movie, but yeah, I mean, it was this whole thing about like one, just again, the timing, right? Like your lives would be very different if you became immortal in, 600 BC and then on, as opposed to that immortality starting now when there is, social media and all of this places that are faces, or I guess you could get a ton of plastic surgery every so often, but then you'd really have to get wealthy quick.
Yeah, or every 50 years move to a different continent and just work your way around all seven. that could work. And so you're just moving. I'm now going to Siberia for 50 years. Now let's go to Africa and see how that works out for another 50. Like, it's a really tough, that'd be a lot of work.
All the time in the world to do such work.
So anyway. Kathy, you raised the issue about community property versus separate property states. Because we know there's California and Louisiana at play, but there might be others. Can you help us understand what those issues could be for Mr. Immortal?
So this is one of the things that occurred to me as I was watching them discussing the settlement and specifically why, if you are going through a divorce or any family law issues, you should get someone who's an attorney who specializes in family law and not use an attorney who does up and practices in other areas, because it is so specific, and especially in community property states, the rules are very, very different. And so community property states, which are mostly in the West Coast, but Louisiana is also a community property state because it was, its foundings are French. But basically, when you get when you come to the marriage, everything that you own is your own separate property. But after you get married, the things that you, your earnings are considered community property. It, there are some exceptions, you know, if you are given gifts, you know, or receive an inheritance that is specifically one for one spouse in the marriage, then that would be considered their separate property, even if they earned it while they were in the marriage. But so in a community property state, when you divorce, then you have to determine what's the value of what's separate property, what is community property. And then, you know, unless there's a prenup or some other something else comes into play, each spouse would get half of that.
And so, it's going to get weird and complicated because most people don't have like eight spouses from different states.
And legally, technically, neither does Mr. Immortal.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, you know, the argument for him is easy, right? He's like, married? What do you mean? It's against the law to be married to all these people.
I died, therefore it's okay. Like, and again, it stems from, I'm afraid of conflict and speaking to someone I have an intimate relationship with. Therefore, I'll just throw myself out the window. Not the grown-up thing to do. So
he's lived so many years and never grown up.
Do you think he signed 8 marriage certificates?
Probably.
Because I remember when Sarah and I got married, there was a lot of paperwork to be done.
And technically, even if it is how he thinks it is, or he's alleging that he actually died, he does not have the assets that he thinks he does. They're not going to be his. They will have either been used to pay off previous spouse's debts or existing debts at the time of his technical death, if that's what he wants to call it. And so whatever he thinks he owns right now is probably not going to be true because it'll be somebody else's.
Yeah. If we want to play that game, if death ended the marriage, then the spouse inherited everything that he had from that marriage, which then gets really complicated because if it is separate property and the rules that apply to someone dying intestate who's married, and what happens to the separate property and the community property if there is a will or if there isn't a will. So if he like willed it to his next identity, problematic, but that goes to the issue of, it's a fraudulent act to get out of a marriage. And if he thinks he's still retaining all the property, that cuts against his argument. So now, Daphne, you brought in, you just touched on this with the gold from his first wife, Baroness Cromwell, which again, sounds like we're talking pre-United States for this.
Yeah, that does sound like that was from quite a long time ago. So whatever that was from, he entered into whatever first marriage it is that's existing right now, assuming that was from a long time ago, with that as separate property. But again, presuming that it is how he says it is, that he actually died, then all of that gold would have gone to that first wife, or potentially to pay off whatever debts were there, or his heir, if there was anything from the estate after that. If it's not how he thinks it is, and now we just have an existing wife and multiple invalid marriages, now maybe he has a little bit of separate property right there. But you know, if we move on to those Apple shares, he didn't acquire those prior to all of these people, but assuming that he didn't, how did he pay for those? Did he sell off some of that gold and use that to pay for the shares? Maybe it's still separate property then. If not, if he acquired those shares with somebody else, there's somebody, one of these partners might have the right to a 50% interest in those shares.
If that spouse is still alive from 78, you know, like, or 81, like when the founding of Apple is a beautiful, complex story. And if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, going to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View is a cool thing to do because you can go see the Apple I with the wood frame and everything. You can go see the original Pong game that was originally played at Andy Capp's which eventually became Rooster Teeth Feathers, the comedy club that my parents owned. So yeah, you can, there's a lot to go chase down with that fun issue of when did he get involved with Apple? And was he married when that happened? So good times and great analysis. Now here's a fun one. While the lawyer and paralegal are discussing the merits of their client's case, he jumps out the window. Who pays for the window? I would say that's an intentional act by him, so he's on the hook for that.
Oh, for sure. That's just put that right in his bill, assuming that he's the kind of person that pays his bills and doesn't die to get away from.
Get the retainer up front. You know, that's why we have retainers. So I've never seen a client do that, never want to. But we also then have the issue of child support because there's at least one kid. There could be other, there could be great grandkids from other marriages running around as well. So again, it gets weird that he literally could have descendants.
And this is where we go back to that concern about the ethics of having all of these partners in one room and unrepresented. And so now you also have children who may be unrepresented. And so the settlement might come down in a way that's not in the best interest of children of any of these marriages. So yeah, we need to get people who are represented in that room in order to really protect everybody's rights.
So I'm not a family law attorney, but I remember something in California that the community pays for counsel for both spouses. So that way you don't have a situation of, you know, husband saying, it's my money. I want her to suffer and die. Therefore, I'm going to get a lawyer to go through her with a chainsaw and give her the worst terms humanly possible. And we'll just starve her out because she can't afford any of the legal fees. And we're just going to be absolutely cruel. We have protections to make sure that sort of thing doesn't happen by saying, you can't cut off food and you still have to provide support to the community on figuring out when the community breaks, but there has to be representation. So I think there was something that was added about that. But again, I don't focus on this area. I'm general civil lit, but there's something afoot there that I think we do need to follow up on.
I do know that the state bar, California state bar, is considering a category of legal professionals called a paraprofessional, which would be able to perform certain duties that currently only attorneys can do. I guess it's kind of more of like a paralegal. I don't know where the legislation is or if they've written the legislation yet, but there's been talk, the state bar has been kind of doing studies about it, but it seems like it would cover something like this, that areas where you need some specific knowledge, but it's not always rising to the level of needing a full attorney. And the idea is it helps with equity, right? Because more people can access legal help. Because a paraprofessional would cost significantly less than an attorney, but also it expands job opportunities available to people who might not be able to have the resources to attend law school. Family law would be one of the things that areas that they are looking at, like immigration, things like that.
Oregon just passed something like that through our bar. So we have... At least within the last couple of months, we've started having stuff that the kind of paraprofessionals, the paralegals can do. I don't know a ton about it, but I know we passed something like that.
Now, Daphne, you just looked up the actual law, so thank you for doing that. Can you walk us through what the code says about attorney's fees?
Sure. This is not my practice area either, but I did find Family Code section, this is chapter 3.5 for attorney's fees and costs. And so that section 2030 says that in a proceeding for dissolution of marriage, nullity of marriage, or legal separation of the parties, and in any proceeding subsequent to the entry of a related judgment, that the court shall ensure that each party has access to legal representation, including access early in the proceedings to preserve each party's rights by ordering, if necessary, based on the income and needs assessments, one party, except a governmental entity, to pay to the other party or to the other party's attorney whatever amount is reasonably necessary for the attorney's fees and costs of maintaining or defending the proceeding during the pendency of the proceeding. So that tells me, there's going to be a judge that can jump in here and say, yeah, we're pulling out money from wherever it is that is available and make it fair so that each party is going to get equal and fair representation here.
I like it when my memory's right. So that's, and that more importantly, we have fundamental fairness. Like there's wow. There's something called civil Gideon, which is coming up in the immigration context of making sure that, a 2-year-old before an immigration judge, who's a refugee actually gets representation, because right now the system is they don't get representation. And that's a hot button issue right now, because there are federal judges who believe in it, that you have Gideon's and the Gideon's trumpet are the examples of get an attorney if you're arrested. So you have the right to counsel. You should have the right to counsel in situations where it's like an immigration proceeding and you're getting, are you a refugee or not? And right now the answer is no, like you don't get counsel, which is why we have immigration judges figuring out if a 2-year-old qualifies as a refugee. And that just seems a little scary that the federal government is saying, no, they don't. And you get the judge, having to help weigh in on this. All of that said, let's get to the wedding. So.
Oh, can we do one more thing before we bounce off of this?
Yes. Go right ahead.
So there's one other thing to consider in that, which is that Mr. Immortal's kid, if he ever got any kind of public benefits, the government can get involved in that and claim child support against Mr. Immortal. And so he might be on the hook for, I don't know how old the kid was supposed to be, but he might be on the hook for back child support, and they can't negotiate that away in the divorce settlement mediation proceeding, whatever they're doing, because the government's going to get what's due to it, and the government always gets theirs in these family law things.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot there. And Kathy, other issue with the child.
I think his name was Spencer. But so Spencer also, so let's say Mr. Immortal dies and leaves behind a kid. If he would have worked, qualifying number of years to get Social Security, the child would have received Social Security benefits, his father's Social Security benefits up until the time he turned 18. So there's a possibility too that if that was all a fraud, right, then he may not be, or that he may be on the hook for that as well.
Good catch. That's well done.
I think this all goes back to the format, right? We're looking at all these parties. Now we have, Jordan and Kathy just mentioned, other ways in which this pot really must be split. And so you have people in the room who can be paid something, but can also negotiate away whatever it is that's valuable or not valuable to them. 20 seconds of eye contact and I don't need any money, done, good. But there are parties who might not be in this room who are owed an amount, and that's either going to be statutorily owed or not something that can be negotiated away. And so this whole format is problematic, yeah, at the very least.
That the settlement agreement might be invalid for a whole bunch of reasons, because you're negotiating the rights of others and you're skirting around criminal liability Are you just going to hope that we're going to put in a non-disclosure agreement? And that's her way of saying you can't talk about this to report him for what he did and criminal prosecution, either state or federal. And it could be multiple states as well. So it's, oh, it's so horrid. Any other points on Mr. Immortal?
I guess just the one other thing is, if you're hiring a lawyer and their paralegal is negotiating the case for you and their paralegal ups what you're having to do in a way that is harmful to you, that can probably be considered malpractice. And I think Nikki, if she were my paralegal and she raised the stakes by, what is it, about a third, some 15 seconds to 20 seconds of eye contact. I mean, it's dumb, and you can think eye contact, haha, that's a silly thing, but that's something he doesn't want to do. And she's upping it just because he's annoying. And that's how you get bar complaints. And that's how paralegals get fired. So Nikki, I don't know. I think she stepped in it pretty big there.
But she's doing it with the attorney in the room. So there's arguably the supervision that's taking place, but it's a very dangerous path to be on. It's, for those who watch Daredevil, there were tons of issues with Karen Page playing legal assistant without training to be a legal assistant, and her doing things that a legal assistant would not do, to the point where they're like, hey, let's rename the law firm. You know, we'll put the legal assistant's name in the name of the law firm. No. You don't get to do that. You have to be a lawyer to have your name in the law firm name. So there's big issues there.
And that blows back on the lawyer.
Oh, God. Yeah. Any other topics for Mr. Immortal before we get to the wedding? Okay. So I will begin with, watching all of this made me super uncomfortable because it feeds into the narrative of the bridezilla who wants to kneecap all of her bridesmaids to make sure the bride is the most attractive one at the wedding. Therefore, all the bridesmaids have to dress as kaiju in order to not upstage the bride. So I was just like creeped out by that. It was just upsetting. I appreciate the realism that the emotionally intelligent person who was very sensitive was named Josh. That was hyper realistic. And I really appreciated that part.
But is he going to turn out to be a bad guy?
No. No, they would not do that. They would not do that. No.
I think in any other Marvel show, he almost certainly would, but I don't think this one he's coming back.
He might get killed horribly. So she might find his corpse in a refrigerator. But I don't think the leader is contracting out Josh to stick her with a big needle. And I really do believe it's the leader who we're going to see as the big bad. But that's me just being optimistic. So anyway, with that aside, we get into the bridesmaid fight. And there's a lot to unpack here. So there's a difference between self-defense and mutual combat. We have a long tradition of self-defense laws in the state of California. It's defined under Civil Code Section 50. Any force necessary may be used to protect from wrongful injury the person or property of oneself or a wife or husband, child, parent, or other relative, or other member of one's family, or a ward, master, or a guest. And that's been expanded to, you can protect someone who's being threatened. So it doesn't have to be a family member anymore. But you definitely get to protect yourself. Mutual combat, on the other hand, is a fight when it is begun by or continued by mutual consent or agreement. So this isn't like a fun boxing match. This is two individuals who have a problem with each other and they decide to slug it out at a wedding. At least that's what I think. Who would like to help understand the altercation that happens between Titania and Jennifer, whether that's self-defense or mutual combat. Who wants to take the first swing?
Take the first swing, really?
Yes, yes.
All right.
I'm going to do four Stackerman type puns until I die. So, like, yeah, let's do this. So
the way I saw it, the way I would take it is Titania very much sucker punches Jen. So I think if Jen had reacted right there and fought her back, that would have been self-defense. But they take the time to have this whole conversation about it, and it becomes pretty obvious that if Jen doesn't transform into She-Hulk, Titania is just going to yell at her and walk away, because she doesn't want to fight Jen. She wants to fight She-Hulk. So Jen then decides to change into She-Hulk and fight back, which, you know, fun to watch. It was a good fight scene. But that feels a lot more like mutual combat than self-defense. That's fine. You want to do this. Let's do this. We'll settle it. And not, oh God, there's an imminent threat to my safety. I better, you know, take some action.
At your high school friend's wedding.
Or wherever.
Yeah, where. It's just, location doesn't matter. It's just rude to do it at somebody else's wedding, though. So, like, that's, you're purposely stealing the center stage to punch someone through the wedding party. So, problematic. I agree it's mutual combat. Does anyone have a different view? No, I see heads shaking no that no, this turned into mutual combat. So Mark made some additions and I wish he was here, but you know, a waiter gets injured, and there's some property damage that takes place. If he jumps in, we'll definitely touch that. But Kathy, you raised a couple issues with having a fight at the wedding.
When I saw Mark's notes in the outline about the injuries, you know, to and the property damage, and then I started thinking, like, well, is there who, you know, in that situation? Okay, who's liable? Who would be sued? Who would be the plaintiff? Who would be the defendant? And then I was like, well, is there social host liability too? Because, you know, could Lulu being the, and her groom being the hosts of the wedding, or the wedding venue, could they be responsible for the damages? Because Jen was overserved. She was kind of drunk when this all happened. And in California, there is a social host liability law. It's California Civil Code, Section 1713, which says that the furnishing of alcoholic beverages is not the proximate cause of injuries resulting from intoxication, but rather the consumption of alcoholic beverages is the proximate cause of injuries inflicted by an intoxicated person. So basically what that means is just because you furnished the alcohol doesn't make you liable if somebody then consumes that alcohol and goes and gets drunk and causes injury to somebody else. There are exceptions to that. If you are giving alcohol, furnishing alcohol to someone you know or reasonably should know is a minor, then the social host liability would not apply. They would be liable in that instance. But in this situation, I thought that there were a couple. So in addition to the social host liability laws, I'm assuming the wedding's in California, which I think is reasonable given we're based in LA, but it was also a cash bar. So, which, you know, is a little insulting to your wedding guests, but it's Jen who's paying for her own drinks. So she, you know, so even if there was no social host liability, because it's a cash bar, I think, you know, you've got a little bit of a different situation because you're not really, as the host, or the bride and groom, you're not really furnishing the alcohol. It's available. No, the wedding venue is furnishing it. And she was overserved. And there are issues with their liquor license, most likely, if they're overserving people and that's causing all this destructive damage. But Under California law, there would be no liability for the social host.
Great analysis. There's a wrinkle, though, because when she hulks out,
right,
different metabolism, so she would sober up. She sobered up immediately. So she clearly knows right from wrong at this point in time. So turning into the Hulk form arguably is because she was intoxicated, but that would have cleared up the moment she turned green. So there's, it's a very messy situation. I hope she has a nice umbrella policy to help with any damages that she needs to pay for. A lot there. Now with that, Mark, great seeing you. I see the cats with you. And how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. Sorry for the delay there. We were taping this on the beginning of the Jewish New Year, and I was at Rosh Hashanah dinner. But She-Hulk still requires participation, regardless of the Jewish New Year. So this wasn't a very legalistic episode of all the ones I guess we've probably seen so far. I think this had the least amount of fact patterns that had issues. Given what you guys were talking about, I can tell you already gone through most of them. I will say, I thought that same thing, Josh, question in my mind of as soon as she became She-Hulk, is she still drunk or not? We know as being She-Hulk, supposedly she doesn't get drunk. But if she's drunk as Jen and she becomes She-Hulk, does that make a difference? I don't know the answer to that. I guess the friend could also say she never, in fact, she said this in the beginning, she didn't invite She-Hulk. So She-Hulk is an uninvited guest. So maybe that would minimize her liability as well and put it on Jen. And I will also say that if she's in the LA, I've been to LA many, many times. And those were really expensive drinks, unless she was buying more than one at a time at someone's wedding. I think she was putting down at least like $11 a drink. That's not cheap at a wedding. No, at a cash bar.
That's insulting. Like,
yeah, that's very, very insulting. I think the only thing I guess I'll add on this episode, when I was doing a little bit of research on it, that the thing that I have been most impressed with the series, which has nothing to do with the legal aspects, is I think of all the series, and maybe, I mean, we analyzed, I participated in a bunch of the analyzation of some of the other series, and they are really putting in minute facts that aren't really substantive storylines that tie into the Marvel universe and the comic book universe. It seemingly appears more than in other of the series. And I mean, that is obviously deliberate, and it's very interesting because I guess it gives them avenues towards the future if they want to keep expanding into more television series, that they've introduced all these characters that people are probably not even paying any attention to whatsoever, because it'll literally be some of the background information in a newspaper article that if you're not doing stop motion, you're not even really seeing it to be able to read that so-and-so's name was mentioned. And the one point that came up when this, where was it? If you guys remember in Avengers, is it Civil War? I think the bad guy who was missing an arm, he had a fake arm. He had a foreign accent. Non-American accent.
The South African guy from...
Yeah, South African guy.
Yeah. The Claw.
Claw.
Thank you.
Killed off in Black Panther.
Yes. He was part... And maybe one of you guys can remind me what this is, because I'm drawing a blank. He was part of an organization that was mentioned in passing in this last episode of She-Hulk.
I did not catch that.
I didn't catch it. I was having to read it. Google is our friend.
Intelligentsia.
Right?
There was a reference to that.
Yes. That's it. So there was an interesting connection between that. And you know what that means? Not a clue. I bet you, I'll dare say, just having dealt with too many Hollywood people over the years, I bet you they have no idea what that means, other than they just stuck it in there to see that they can go back later on and go, hey, you know, we did do this. We can do an offshoot and see what happens from there. But other than whatever the Mr. Invincible guy, whatever the heck his name was.
Immortal.
Mr. Immortal. You know, that in the fight scene that I came into having you guys discuss, that was really all I saw from a legal standpoint.
We had a lot of fun with Mr. Immortal.
And, I'll bet.
And when, you know, what's the definition of death? And all of the if ex-spouses were collecting insurance benefits, there is a little case law on that where it was from turn of the 20th century, very early on, where guy supposedly dies because no one's seen him in 7 years. So the wife gets the money, then the dude shows up alive. And there's the issue of, does the insurance company get the money back? And I don't remember the holding on it because it's been 8 years since I looked at it. So, but that was the, I did a bunch of analysis on the show Resurrection when that came out. Because it was having people come back from the dead after 30 years. So
problem. Well, I guess because that there has to be, it seems, in every episode for us as lawyers where we go, oh, come on, seriously? Did you really need to do that? So why is the paralegal negotiating divorce settlements? Really? It couldn't have been the other lawyer who was already negotiating? I mean, that would have been fine, right? But no, the paralegal, I mean, who does that? I'm sorry.
So my only theory on that is that Nikki is a certified mediator and she was doing it as a mediation.
Okay. So at least it will make sense then, I hope.
Here's something we didn't put on the outline. So Nikki and Book go to the website where they see that there are death threats against She-Hulk. And the lawyer says, let's not tell Jennifer about there are people who want to kill her. Nikki disregards that and leaves a voicemail for her friend saying, oh, by the way, there are people who are posting creepy things about you, about killing you. Was there a duty to warn Jennifer about these online threats?
I can't think of what would create that duty.
There's a special relationship, an employer-employee relationship there. I think we went over this when we did our Peacemaker panel at WonderCon. I think this came up. Although we were probably looking at Washington law in that case. But there I believe there is a special duty or a duty owed when there's a special relationship and employer-employee is one of them. And then additionally...
But is it employer to employee or can it be employee to employer?
That's a good question.
The employee. I mean, actually, right. Jennifer's not the employer.
GLK, right, is the employer of all interested parties.
And Jennifer technically outranks Book. So from being the division lead to not. But yeah, there's...
And how credible this threat is, right? Like this, to me, given the context of these women, it just... sound, you know, like, I mean, at the end scene, then we realize like this is a actual real threat, but it sort of comes off as any, you know, celebrity hate mail sort of thing, right? Like they've talked about how hard it is to be a woman. And like, of course, there's a website of people, men talking about how they want to murder you. Like, well, of course, that's what men on the internet do. This is no more than, you know, this is usual.
But I forget, is the other attorney, is she a partner in the law firm or is she also basically Jennifer's peer?
I think they're peers. I'm trying to remember the scene where she's introduced. It seemed like she, like I'm vaguely remembering that it sounds like she's someone who's supposed to like sort of work with Jen on some of her cases as opposed to like supervisor in any sort of context.
Okay, so no responsibility on her part to have to I guess, share that information or do anything as like an employer type role. Probably not.
I'm curious if the employer-employee relationship context is specific to the type of threat. I guess in this case, they hired her to Hulk out, right? And so any threat to her as Hulk would matter. I'm just thinking, like, if your employer found out that, you know, because of your other blog that you do and you're not at work, you're getting death threats, like that would seem to not be related. But I guess in this case, if I think Galloway, I can't remember his name, the boss, if he had become, you know, informed about threats to her specifically as She-Hulk, then I think that would change our analysis.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. If the employer who has hired her to Hulk out and is requiring her to Hulk out, and because she's having to do so now on a regular basis at the request and direction of her employer, if that is causing her to now be at greater risk to her safety, there might be something to consider there.
Yeah. She should invoice them for her. Oh, I was going to say for security, but she's a Hulk, so I don't know who she's hiring as security.
Kathy, you just put in a note in chat. Can you share that with the listeners, please?
So the employer can also seek a temporary restraining order on her behalf, at least in California, where they have information about these threats to her and that it could impact her workplace, right? So they could then go to court and get a restraining order against these people who are making these threats, you know, assuming we know who they are, they can be served or whatever, protect, at least get an order of protection to not only protect Jen and She-Hulk, but the other employees, right? Because not only do they have a duty to Jen, I think, but if you know that there are threats where something could happen, violence could result in the workplace, you have a duty to your other employees to provide a safe work environment.
Yeah, if an anti-tank missile hits the corner office where Jennifer is, there's going to be collateral damage to the other employees who are outside the door in the neighboring offices. Like that seems grossly irresponsible in an era of workplace violence to not take any action and to not report it to the supervising partner. So I think it's problematic to go, let's not ruin her day and we won't tell her about it. But that also goes to the issue of her not saying anything about the attempt on her life by the wrecking crew. So there's a bunch of issues there.
So maybe they just have this whole practice group in a bunker somewhere.
Yeah, it's again, it's like, think of everyone that works for her that reports to her. It's like, by the way, you're all a target as well. I mean, that's something that people would want to know about, that you too could be maimed or killed by people who want to kill She-Hulk. So it's a very scary, scary thing to go, let's go day drinking now. Like that's a really, that's the wrong response. So with that said, great analysis, everyone. And thank you all for tuning in. Wherever you listen, please leave a review for us, and we will be back with more legal analysis. And until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay geeky.